Good evening and welcome to Oscar Live, proudly brought to you by the Old Scotch Collegians Association. My name's Scott Montgomery, Oscar's Executive Director. Tonight's special guest is the Honourable Dan Tehan, MP, Member for Wannon and Minister for Education.
We're going to have this a journey from the farm to federal politics with Dan. I'll just make first up reference that I've known Dan for quite some time now, since our days as combative on the football field and golf, and from university days. So Minister, I'm just going to call you Dan. Is that okay?
That's fine, Scott. No problems.
Excellent. So rather than go straight back to the farm where you began your journey, I just thought I'd start with your inaugural speech back in 2010 and your speech to Parliament. And in particular, your reference to those that you looked after, particularly your mum, Marie Tia, the late Marie Tia, and the influence that your parents had and sort of guiding you as to where you came from and where you get to today.
Yeah, no, thanks. And look, it's an excellent question. It's a great place to start because really they were the two people who instilled in me this idea of service and giving back to your community. My father did it locally, and his father, my grandfather, did it also through local government, but also through the BFF and the National Farmers Federation. And my mother was a member of Parliament, member of the Victorian Parliament, a member of the Kennett government. She was Health Minister and Minister for Conservation, Forests and Land. And we always discussed issues around the kitchen table. We were always debating and discussing what government should or shouldn't be doing, how we should be contributing to the local community, and that left with me a great sense of duty and service, and what they have instilled in me has gone a long way to where I am now and the position that I'm in, and you know, eternally grateful for the role models that I had in both my parents.
Yeah, and I was just saying, thinking, were you very nervous in your first speech in Parliament? I think I would have been.
Incredibly nervous.
It was a great speech.
And I'm still nervous when I speak in the Parliament because everything you say in there is recorded. You will be held to account from what you say. And obviously it's a chamber where there's a lot of combat, verbal combat, which takes place. And if you make mistakes or make errors, the opposition in particular will pounce on that. So it's like any big event, whether it be on the sporting field or on the if you're appearing on the stage when it comes to the theatre, you've got to make sure that you get it right. Otherwise, you will definitely be held to account if you don't.
Yeah. So growing up in rural Victoria, how's that influenced your journey?
Look, I think I had one of the most fortunate upbringings that you could wish. Growing up on a family farm, I was one of six children. We had a lot of freedom, and it was just a wonderful environment to grow and develop. And you know, the experiences that I have with my brothers and sisters, whether it be getting the school bus into primary school or to secondary school, working on the farm, Dad always made sure that we were contributing from a very young age. So really from about the ages of four or five, we worked on the farm, and that was fantastic as well. And also what that did was you mix with everyone, whether it be the shearers, the rouseabouts, the people who came in to help with the fencing or the people who worked on the farm. And it was incredibly fortunate upbringing on, you know, in a location which I think is one of the more beautiful parts of Australia. So I was very, very fortunate.
I'll let everyone know that you went to school up the road to our arch enemies, Xavier College. So we won't hold that against you, Dan, but you were a boarder there, and do you have any highlights, and in particular, the future of boarding as you see it going forward?
Yeah. Look, the highlight of my boarding experience was the friendships that I made, and they're lifelong friendships that will be with me for the whole of my life. We still, as boarders, my year group in 1985. Every grand final eve, we'll catch up. We have dinner at a venue in Melbourne, and we still have at least 14 or 15 of the boarders will come every single year to that. And they're lifelong friendships. And I think boarding is just a fantastic experience. And I hope that we will be able to see boarding continue, because I think it offers opportunity, especially for those kids who grow up in regional and rural areas, to really be able to experience the best of education and city life, if that's what they want to do. So I think it's incredibly important that we continue to offer boarding as an alternative for students, especially from regional and rural areas.
When you left, year 12 and 85, you did a gap year, and that may not have been so popular back then, but certainly all the rage now. What's your experience of that time, and do you encourage the gap year?
Look, I do. I went back and worked on the family farm for a year. Mum and Dad had a view that the family farm had put us through boarding school. Therefore, we should come back and contribute back to the farm. And I think it enabled me, especially as a young male, to grow through that year of working. I played local football and local cricket. And then when I went to university, I think I was a little bit more mature than I would have been if I had have gone to university straight out of school. So I don't think a gap year is for everyone, but I think for those who maybe aren't certain about where they want to go, what they want to do, taking a year to think about it and to work for a year and get that experience of working, which I also think is incredibly important, is something that is well worth thinking about.
Excellent. Moving beyond your gap year and sort of how your career evolved into where you are today. So let's start that journey. Your first job was in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. So how did this come about?
Look, I ended up doing a Masters of International Relations at Melbourne University. And I then went to the University of Kent in Canterbury and did further studies in international relations there. So I thought that pursuing a career as a diplomat would be something which could be of great interest, and was lucky enough to be able to get into the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade as a graduate, and then was posted to Mexico City, where we looked after Central America and Cuba. And it was, once again, just a wonderful opportunity. They taught me Spanish, gave me Spanish language skills, which was also another skill that I was able to achieve through that. And it was very good grounding to learn how the public service operates and to get an understanding of how you can utilise the public service and what a wonderful asset it is to this country, which has stood me in very good stead as a minister, understanding how important it is to make sure that you can work closely with departmental officials. Especially if you're going to implement policy very well.
Because I was going to ask you about that journey into Mexico. That would have been fascinating. And you were a diplomat. Is that right? And so what does a diplomat do at a young age when you would have been in your 20s?
Yeah, so it's what you're there doing is pursuing Australia's interests in Mexico and Central America and Cuba. And what you want to make sure is that any decisions that might be being taken, whether they're to do with the bilateral relationship, which the focus is on trade with Mexico, or whether in multilateral fora, so when it comes to arms disarmament or UNESCO environmental policy, that you're looking after and pursuing Australia's interests with the Mexican government or governments of Central America and Cuba. And for someone setting out on their career, once again, just fantastic opportunity. I'd been there 3 months, and the ambassador said to me I needed to go to Cuba to make sure that we could get a good working relationship with the Cuban government and also with local journalists and others there, other officials from other embassies, so that we could be able to report thoroughly on Cuba. One of the things about that which has always stuck with me was I met a journalist there who worked for AAP, whose wife was Cuban. And I'd heard from Cuban officials how wonderful their health system was in Cuba and how they exported doctors to places like Angola and Mozambique. But he then told me the experience of his wife when she went to a hospital in Havana to have their first baby. And the lack of resources was such that she had to take her own linen with her. She had to take her own toilet paper with her and her own light bulb. So it gave you a sense of how, with socialist regimes, the misallocation of resources can be quite stark, because all of it was going into producing doctors so that they could talk about it and glorify it and how they could pronounce how they were exporting them. But yet what they were doing in terms of looking after their own citizens was pretty stark.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good, but what an experience for you. So at what point did you decide on pursuing a career in politics? Or was it a case of taking opportunities as they came your way? And I suspect that's certainly your journey.
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. Having moved to Canberra to pursue a career in the Foreign Service, when I got back from Mexico, I was asked by Australia's then Trade Minister, Mark Vaile, to come and work for him. So I went up to Parliament House and worked for the Howard government. And it gave me a very good insight into how politics works at the federal level. And I think that's when I really started to think, this would be a great career path and something worth pursuing. So it was really that opportunity of working for Australia's Trade Minister that really the desire to try and do something similar came about.
And so what drove you to stand for election, if we go forward from there? And did you have someone that you looked up to as a mentor that looked after you and guided you?
So the thing that made me decide was opportunity came knocking. I was working in Melbourne. I was working for the Victorian Liberal Party as their deputy state director. And there was a retirement in the seat of Wannon. David Hawker, the then sitting member who'd been a Speaker of the House of Representatives, decided to retire. And I was approached to see whether I would consider standing. And given the nature of the seat and that the timing was right, I thought I would give it a go. So there were 10 people who put their hand up for Liberal Party pre-selection. And I was fortunate enough to be selected out of those 10. And when it comes to the people who sort of guided me and mentored me, Mark Vaile had a big impact. Dr. Dennis Napthine, the former Premier of Victoria, also had a very big impact on me deciding to pursue the career and the seat. And he really helped and guided me right through the process. He worked with my mother when she was Health Minister in the Kennett government. So he had a strong linkages and relationship with the family. And I'm still incredibly close to Dennis, and he's still someone I go to. To get advice from.
Yeah, I see him a bit down at Port Ferry over summer.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a regular down there. I think he resides down there, I think.
He does reside down there. And even though he's retired from politics, he can't leave him. He still goes around. He's talking to everyone, knows everyone, wants to know what's going on. He's a lovely.
Yeah, he's on the hustle down there. Yeah. So then you were elected to the House of Reps for the seat of Wannon, in 2010. It's almost coming up to 10 years, Dan. I'm looking forward to that celebration 10-year party. So what was that like? Sort of that electoral victory must have been pretty sweet for you.
Yeah, it is. It's incredibly rewarding because you put a hell of a lot of hard work into getting elected to Parliament. So first, there was the pre-selection process, which took about 10 months, and you end up having to put yourself before 400 people who vote as to who would be their preferred candidate to represent the Liberal Party. And then we had 12 months in the lead up to the 2010 election. And once again, it was hard fought. There were 9 people who stood for election at that 2010 election for the seat of Wannon. And it's quite trying. It can get quite tense. It gets very political. So once the election day comes around and that vote count occurs and that you see that that your name come up and that you've been elected as the member for Wannon as a great sense of satisfaction and a real sense of reward for effort. So it's a feeling that I won't forget.
No, well done. So moving forward to 2016, you were elected to Minister for Veteran Affairs. And I was interested in that period, particularly around the centenary of the ANZAC. And then the Scotch link with the future opening of the John Monash Centre at Villers-Bretonneux. So I was just thinking of your involvement there and your period that during that time.
Yeah, look, just a huge honour, one of the great honours of my life to have been appointed Veterans Affairs Minister at that time. It was that centenary of ANZAC period, so I had the great honour of being able to give the address at the Dawn Service at Gallipoli, and it's one of the most moving things I've ever done to those who have been to Gallipoli. That Dawn Service is something that is quite extraordinary, and as the sun's coming up and you hear the water ripple against Anzac Cove and that service takes place, there is a chill which just comes over Anzac Cove. And one of the great moments, one of the great honours of my life, and was able to do the same at Villers-Bretonneux as well. So it was just an extraordinary 2 years. And one of the responsibilities I had was to... we made the investment to build the Sir John Monash Centre, but it was making sure that, having made the investment, that we got it built on time and on budget. And I had to oversee that process. And it's a wonderful legacy that we now have as a nation, the Sir John Monash Centre. And I think it'll be something which future generations of our nation will go and visit, and will always be able to remember that commitment that was made by so many Australians during the First World War in particular. And I think it was a wonderful initiative and wonderful to be a part of.
Yeah, I'd really like to get there one day, and I'm sure many of our listeners would as well. So there was a period where you were involved in the cyber security, and it certainly reared its head recently with some of our Russia in particular. And it is an interesting space because we take it for granted when you log on and then you just think everything's safe. So any insights into that sort of field that you were there? And I'm not sure that you, what your background was to even be put into that position would be interesting in itself.
Yeah, look, I didn't have a strong background in cyber security per se. I chaired our Intelligence and Security Committee of the Federal Parliament in the lead up to it. So that had given me a fairly good insight, but in terms of cyber skills particularly, I didn't have a great strength in that area. It was a real eye-opener. I was the first minister appointed to look after cyber security in the federal parliament, and it was a time of great change. We had the first cyber security policy that we had to implement. We had to set up and establish the Australian Cyber Security Centre, which is now operating and acts to keep us safe in the cyber sphere. So once again, incredible experience. And the lesson that I learned from that is anything you do online, you should always be looking to protect yourself and make sure that you're operating in the most secure environment possible, because whether it be those who are cyber criminals who are looking to exploit constantly online, or those state actors who are also looking to use the internet for nefarious means, we've always got to make sure that we're on guard. And especially when it comes to our children, we should always be saying to them, please look after yourself, protect yourself, and make sure that anything you do online, you'd be happy to do in public, because sadly, there are more and more people out there trying to exploit the internet for the wrong reasons.
Well, that's a very good message. So now that you're Minister for Education, and a very big responsibility you have, and it's close to us, obviously, here at Scotch College. So a couple of questions that have been registered through, and I'll just go through a few of them if I could. So one of them was, how will the experience of remote teaching in 2020 shape the future of education? And perhaps should the federal government take a bigger involvement in the Australian education system?
So I think it will inform education going forward, because I think it, what it has taught us is that you, we can use online learning in many ways, and in ways that I think can benefit students' education. You take the example, for instance, if people are sick or ill, there is a, now, I think we've got that, we should have the provisions to be able to provide, you know, in a sensible way, those ability for those children to be able to learn online while they're away from school. If you're away from school for disciplinary purposes, I think it's very good that education can continue during that time. I think if we want to bring people together and students together from a variety of schools, I think online gives us the tools to be able to do it. I think if you look at schools, for instance, which have various campuses, you'll be able to use online so that teachers will be able to teach to multiple campuses. So I think there's a lot of things that we can learn from online learning. I think, though, one of the things that it has taught us as well is that face-to-face learning is incredibly important. And I think people now have a true understanding of the role that a teacher has to the education of a student. And I think a lot of parents through this process have learned to admire our teachers a lot more. And I think that's been one of the real benefits from this, because our teachers do outstanding work. And as parents, I think we need to understand and appreciate that. So I think that's another strength that's come from it. With regards to further federal government responsibility when it comes to education, on the schools front, it's a vexed issue. Obviously, the states and territories guard their responsibility for the school education very closely. But I think what it's taught us is the more we can work collaboratively together, and, you know, on the whole, I think the more that we can get more uniformity, especially across states and territories, when it comes to year 11 and year 12 in particular, the better. And I think also over time, what I'd like to see is the ability for our teachers to move more seamlessly between states and territories. That would also be a very good outcome.
Yeah, that's good. A question, it's a bit of a long one, but it's from an old boy that I respect greatly. It's with regards to funding in the UK. So the UK, which has had 10 times the number of COVID-19 infections on a per capita basis than Australia, has just invested $300 million of new money in its universities, especially in research and innovation, to enable them to be engine rooms for the revitalisation of their country in the wake of the pandemic. Does the Australian government have similar plans?
So at the moment, we're in discussions with the higher education system here in Australia about achieving a sustainable pipeline of funding for research. One of the things that COVID-19 has done when it comes to our higher education is taken away universities' capacity to earn income through international students. And they often use that income from international students to fund research. So we're in serious discussions with the higher education sector at the moment around what we can do to provide a sustainable level of research funding for this nation, in particular for the next 12 to 18 months, when our universities are going to face some serious challenges because of that decline in international student numbers. So we're looking at what's being done in the UK. We're also looking at what's being done in Canada and in other places. And my hope is that we'll be able to make some decisions out of the October budget, which is coming up, but also in the May budget next year.
Excellent. There was a few questions around your recent policy release with regards to funding for universities and the changes in the fees that current parents and the future students are going to have to pay. That's a topic in itself, and further probably could go beyond the time that we have. But just a quick summary on that and how that's been received and your thoughts on that going forward.
So the challenge we faced as a government is that due to COVID-19, we are going to see a lot more students want to go into higher education. There is a counter-cyclical approach when it comes to youth unemployment and then demand in the higher education system. So we had to find a way to be able to increase the capacity of our higher education system. So that's the key driver of the reforms that we're putting in place. That will see at least another 100,000 students be able to access the system. And our hope is approximately 18 to 20,000 students additionally into the system next year. We've done that by looking at the way that the government funds university, but also the way that students contribute to their courses. And we've put a priority on areas where we think the skill shortages are going to be and where the jobs of the future are going to be into the economy. And so the government is contributing more in those areas, and those areas where there is already strong demand for courses, the government is contributing less, and we're asking the student to contribute more. The other key parts about the changes are about driving greater participation from Indigenous students and students from regional and rural areas. If you look at the attainment rate when it comes to higher education, if you're born in the city, you're twice as likely to go into higher education than if you are in the country. So a lot of the changes are about addressing that, because the last thing we want to see is a great social divide in this country between our cities and our regional and rural areas. And if you look at what's happened in the US and to a lesser extent in the UK, we're starting to see a real linear difference between those who have achieved higher education and those who haven't. And that's causing great divisions in their societies. And that's something we don't want to see here in Australia. That's why I think these reforms are very, very important.
Yeah, that's well done. Thank you. Just a couple more, Dan, if I may. On the completion of the 13-year educational journey of every school year leaver, which three key skills would you like them to have as they leave?
What I'd love them to have is very strong literacy skills, very strong numeracy skills, and then an ability to be able to relate with their fellow students, so they'll be able to go and contribute to society in a very meaningful way. So I think if you've got a student who understands the importance of community and being part of a community, but also has very strong literacy and very strong numeracy skills, I think that sets you up very well for whatever career you might want to pursue or however you might want to contribute to society.
And there's lots of parents listening, and a few of the Year 12 boys I know have registered as well. And so what advice would you give to those guys? My daughter's in Year 12 up at MLC. And they're doing it tough this year, unlike the experience that we had as a Year 12. And the joy that we had and the experiences and the stories that we created during that year. So from the Minister of Education, just some words of encouragement for them, perhaps, just to conclude.
Yeah. Look, you're right. It's been an incredibly tough year. I think they've had to show incredible resilience to be able to deal with it. What I would say to the Year 12 students in particular, if you can deal with this, if you can deal with the challenges that have been thrown at you, you'll be able to deal with any challenge that's thrown at you throughout your life. And if you can make the most of this year, come through it, learn through it, grow through it, then as we come out the other side of this pandemic and as you embark on your future careers or future study, I think you'll be in an incredibly strong place, because for all of us, this has been incredibly tough. But for you in particular, the dreams and the way that you viewed what was going to happen and what actually has happened has been so extraordinarily different that I think if you can deal and cope with this, you'll be able to deal and cope with anything in life. So even though it's been incredibly tough, understand that you will have learned a lot from it, and it will stand you in very good stead for the rest of your life.
Well, Dan, that's a very good message, and thank you very much for that. So that concludes a little chat with you, Dan. I really, really appreciate you accepting my invitation a couple of weeks ago to come on board. And it's always a privilege to play golf with you. And it's terrific that we can have this chat and share your time as Minister for Education to the Scotch community. And terrific job that you are doing. And thanks again for your time.
Thanks, Scott. And this is a great initiative, and well done. It's been a pleasure to come on tonight. And and to talk about a few things, and it's brought about a few recollections, because I don't often pause and think about the journey, especially over the last 10 years. So it's been wonderful to be with you.
Good stuff, Dan. And to everyone out there, keep active, keep well, and good night.